This old woman with oily hair and a jaundiced face hovering over me as I slept, sucking all the color from my soul. I'd wake up screaming, but that's also stopped. You know how? How, Jim? It stopped when I saw you. Here, Georgie knew she'd found a rich, powerful star desperate to be loved, desperate to believe, in Natchez Gushu, in Freudian confusion mistaken for destiny, in anything kinder than chaos. And gazing at his mother's eyes set in Georgie's face, Carrie marveled at the sheer benevolence of a creator who, working through local cable providers, would not only reveal but deliver her to him. Renee, he told Georgie, was only preparation for the true love now at hand. And Georgie, for all her later grievances, hurried to close the deal. Do you know what your aura looks like now? She asked. Well, the colors vary from I can see it. You can? Yes. It's a shining golden light. Whatever his later failings, it was she who kissed him first. Her own miracle, more or less, was also at hand. The journey begun on Greyhound buses crossing Iowa's endless nowhere, arriving at its long-sought somewhere. Want to go upstairs? He asked. She nodded. They went to the master suite. A slow montage of sexual joining suggests that somehow this love is different from all other loves. A dance of wanting bodies, the whispering of impossible promises. The storm's lightning pulsing against the gold-leaf painting that hung above the bed, an orthodox icon of the Virgin Mary, breastfeeding her superstar Bambino, gifted to Carrie by probable murderers during the Russian premiere of Bruce Almighty. Carrie gazes into Georgie's eyes, his mother's eyes, suckles her breast, his mother's breast, moves inside this near-total stranger, like each thrust might restore him to the lost peace of the womb. Come for me, Daddy, she purred. Within 6 months, they had arranged for permanent karmic joining with a Melanesian spirit ceremony held at Kelsey Grammer's home in the Malibu Hills. Paparazzi choppers swarmed overhead, purchased by TMZ from the Marine Corps, still war-painted black. Nicolas Cage served as Jim's spirit witness, breaking from the filming of Bangkok Dangerous to attend the wedding. His stuntman on the production had worked with Georgie's first husband on Fast and Furious 3 and told Cage of their divorce. The poison protein powder, the Mazda Miata theft. He voiced his concerns just days before the wedding when the two friends met at Cage's Bel Air mansion for a Brazilian jiu-jitsu sparring session. Stripped down to their briefs, sun low in the west, they circled each other in a black sand dojo ringed with mastodon skeletons that Cage had won in Mongolian auctions. Carrie often wondered why they always fought at dusk. Was every moment in their lives just a scene demanding setting? Was the trap of persona everywhere upon them? The sun poured raspberry through the ancient rib cages, striping Cage's face in shadow and fire. Pleased with this visual effect, he made his plea. I'm frankly concerned, Jimbo. I say step back from this one. I'm hearing some heavy stories about her past, talking auto theft, talking rat poison. Georgie had already given Carrie her side. Those are her ex-husband's lies. Even the Mamba has its truth. Lumumba? The Mamba. It's a big snake. Look, I think the Renee wound has you falling for a knife fighter who may not mean you well. Georgie's taken my pain away. So would cyanide. Taller and thus favored by the physics of combat, Carrie lunged at Cage, who fought dirty, gouging Carrie's eyes, saying if blindness was what he sought, it was easily achieved. Carrie peeled Cage's hands off his eyes. Cage peeled Carrie's hands from his own hands. Vying bodies became vying fingers. Cage's thumb, unusually large from birth, dominated Carrie's pinky, snapping the digit at its base knuckle. Carrie howled, surged with adrenaline, and threw Cage to the ground. They wrestled until their sweat-slicked bodies were covered in black sand, more suggesting aboriginal demons than millionaire actors. Finally, Cage employed deception. He sighed, relaxed, feigned surrender. Then, just as Carrie relented, Cage crashed an elbow into his head, gashing the flesh of his eyebrow. "You tricked me, only so you'd see. I'm looking out for you, Jimbo. In the scrapyard of dreams that we call home, this polluted meadow of bourgeois fantasy, this common grave of consumerist longing, this neon carrot dangling ever close." "What are you talking about?" Carrie said, eyes swelling shut. "Celebrity, asshole. The Iron Maiden of a mass persona. The Torquemadan impalement of any chance at a true self. What if you're just a means to an end for this woman? Hey, only know what I hear. She's a knife fighter. Push comes to shove, I'm hearing she would bury it to the hilt. I love her," said the dopamine. "I feel it in my soul, Nick. The place where Natchez was leading us. I feel a great peace. Renee was an equal. Everyone approved. Now she's with Don Alfonso. So where did that get me? We need to be loved and touched." And, after pausing to appreciate just how perfectly the fiery sunset and mastodon shadow cleaved his face, Cage said, "We all suffer reverberant primal pains. Ancient men getting eaten by vicious beasts. They wail inside us still. Why do you think we grapple here in this place of aged bones? Vanity? Boredom? Theatrics? Wrong. We battle ancient mojo in my black sand shadow dojo. I just want to be sure you're going into this protected, with eyes open." "There's no need," said Carrie. "Me and Georgie see each other's souls." What was Cage to do? He played his best hand. He gave Carrie a kiss on the cheek, unsure if it was one of blessing or farewell. Days later, Cage stood beside his friend for the Melanesian spirit ceremony at Kelsey Grammer's house. Carrie's eye was still swollen half shut, his pinky splinted. Carrie's daughter, Jane, watched from the front row. He had her with his first wife, Melissa. She was a true child of Hollywood, had once smiled before banks of cameras as her father pressed her 7-year-old hands alongside his in a square of wet cement in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater. Growing up, more honest with herself than most, she wrote in her diary about celebrities' gravitational field. "The older kids want to be my friend just because of my dad. There are real friends and there are fake friends. I don't blame them, but I see it." She'd seen its toll on her father's psyche. The ego-distending adulation, the wrenching fears of abandonment. How the last box office smash only raised the bar for the next project. Watching the ceremony, pregnant with her own child and through that child, perhaps, filled with the hope of better things, she wished only for her father to be truly and lastingly happy with Georgie, who was a lonely bride. Her father was deceased. Her mother claimed sickness to avoid travel. None of her siblings attended. Her only guests were the Stalin girls. There was Oksana herself, played by Caprice Wilder, renegade child bride of a Greenwich hand soap executive who drove to Los Angeles after 9/11, with only a meager alimony and the resolve to die famous. Olga, Oksana's loyal enforcer, played by Lunestra Del Monte, a woman named off of a MySpace plebiscite. She would later claim to have been a Kremlin agent in fact, as well as fiction. And finally, Stalin's youngest daughter, played by Casey Mayhew, a former Memphis River Queen decrowned for making gonzo pornography under the name Ford Explorer. Birds of paradise squawked from golden cages, and a choir of Milesian orphans sang as the newlyweds were showered with hibiscus petals. Carey told Us Magazine that his spirit felt unbound from his body, then felt Georgie's hand turning his face so the cameras could capture his unbrutalized side in a newlywed kiss. All but one guest wished them well. Katie Holmes attended with her then-husband, a colossal action star whose real name, for legal reasons, cannot be given here. Hence, we shall call him Laser Jack Lightning. So there she stood beside Laser Jack, Katie, coal-eyed beauty, who had met Jim in the 27th chamber of Will Smith's backyard labyrinth 2 years before. Together, they had found their way out of the maze, had, like Hansel and Gretel, grown close through shared peril. She noted a woodenness about Jim and Georgie's kiss, an ominousness in the speed with which the bride turned from her groom to the cameras. Why, Katie wondered, eyeing them at the altar, is false love so proud and true love so fearful? She smiled at Carrie with sad concern as he walked down the aisle, while Laser Jack flashed him a billion-dollar grin and a red carpet thumbs up. Jim and Georgie's bliss was so great they made plans to enjoy it forever. At the Pasadena Longevity Center, they had stem cells drawn and proteins synthesized for custom therapies, promising to extend their shared life deep into the 21st century. Age was just a disease, they were assured, curable like any other. And yet bad winds were blowing. Mitchell Silvers went missing from the set of Oksana for 3 days, returning in a semi-stupor, claiming he'd been abducted by an extraterrestrial television producer named Tan Calvin. But Angelinos have breakdowns all the time. Georgie, like most, just assumed he'd changed up his medications. She had always wanted to visit New York, and that September, shortly after the Malibu ceremony, Carrie took her there for what might reasonably be called a honeymoon. They stayed at the Mercer in Soho. Jim dreamed the neighborhood back to its 1980s heyday. He imagined all remnant graffiti the work of Basquiat, painters and poets, and experimental musicians making love in the lofts, a lush, private fantasy of Bohemia. For Georgie, it connoted less artistic purity than brute arrival. Mercer, Green, Wooster, she walked the streets without thought for their artistic or industrial pasts. The posh boutique sang of paradise, and the paparazzi awaiting their exit from the hotel each morning and following them through the days made this, by far, the greatest role of her career, the mad rush of reality TV, minus the sandflies and starvation. Lunching on the sidewalk at Cipriani, she realized that all you had to do was sip water in the presence of Jim Carrey, eat salad with basic table manners, and just like that, you entered social media's theater of a billion eyeballs. In centuries past, you had to kill on the battlefield or make a fortune in cargo shipping to join the aristocracy. But in late America, miracle of miracles, you just needed to consume tuna tartare in the proper context. Her Oksana co-stars sent her heart emoji-adorned links to shots of them on the sidewalk, pictures often taken only minutes before. Soon she was searching Getty Images for fresh visions of herself, meticulously planning the next day's wardrobe for the Jim and Georgie show. They ate dinner in a Chinatown restaurant, happy to discover they were still attracted to each other in overhead fluorescent lighting. They saw Equus at the Schubert Theater, seated front row as guests of Daniel Radcliffe, who received them after in his dressing room, kindly playing along for a photo wherein Georgie, with outstretched, wiggling fingers, appeared to be casting a hex on him. Outside the theater, they ran into Carrie's chief handler at the Creative Artists Agency, Jerry Karkarias, who invited them both to join him at the Christie's Modern and Contemporary Auction the following evening. It was a cool night, streets slick from a light drizzle. They dressed like for the Golden Globes, then piled into the Escalade, the car stereo playing sketches of Spain as they drove up Lafayette, sidewalk lamps shining off the wet streets, Carrie telling Georgie that there was nothing more perfect than listening to Miles Davis in Manhattan in the rain with her. Inside the auction house, they sat with Carcarius and his second wife, Zandora, watching the rich capture treasures. A Warhol Monroe went for $50 million. A Zebra by Damien Hirst, the great embalmer, fetched $25 million. Hockneys and Rauschenbergs fluttered between 5 and 15. Georgie struggled to conceal her exhilaration watching the paddles fly as a Russian oligarch battled Saudi twins for a Basquiat that went for $8 million. And Carrie's mind reeled as Jerry Carcarius bought a hopper for $12 million, the agent seeming to have more disposable cash than any actor Carrie knew. From what place had these dark fortunes been hatched? Then a Frida Kahlo self-portrait went on the block, and Georgie gasped. "You like it?" asked Carrie. She'd always loved Kahlo's work, the feminine fearlessly encountering itself, the heroic struggle to escape from Diego Rivera's shadow. She nodded. "Do you want it?" "Stop. You do, I can see." "Jim!" And with this, sharing heated grins with Georgie after each successful bid, Carrie flew into pursuit. Battling a Dallas oil man, a Japanese retail magnate, an agent of the Sultan of Dubai, all chasing poor Frida from $1 million to $1.2 million, from $1.2 million to $2 million flat, where the Texan dropped out, to $2.2 million, where the Japanese retail magnate quit. Now it was just Carrie against the Sultan's lackey, and he was Jim Carrie. He wasn't going to be bested by some hand-chopping despot. "Do I have 2.8? said the auctioneer. Both met the challenge. 2.9? Carrie raised his paddle like an axe. 3.1? And there it was his. Press captured the moment from 20 different angles, all showing Carrie glowering inappropriately at his vanquished foe, and Georgie in heaven, having received a gift worth more than her family's wealth going back generations. They made love against the window of the hotel suite, both staring out through the glass, and all the windows of the city staring back. Let them watch, both Jim and Georgie felt. Let them share in this moment. Watch us come. Let them feel the joined thrills of spiritual union and victory at auction. Each believed that the other's fevered pledges, "I love you, I'll always love you, I've only loved you," were true, or at least not spoken to deceive. It was all too much to dream, and left Georgie so infatuated with Jim and with the promise of a life filled with moments like this, that she told herself it was just a clerical error when, 2 weeks later, the Frida Kahlo arrived at the Hummingbird Estate and, after unpacking it from its wooden crate, the art handlers gave her a certificate of sale which listed the piece as the sole property of one James Eugene Carey. Chapter 4. Then came the autumn of Mitchell Silver's death. An extraterrestrial subplot emerged in Oksana's fourth and final season when Georgie's character, Nadia Permanova, encountered a wormhole in a Kievan sugar beet field. She was guided through it by sing-song voices, received on the other side by willowy light beings who gave her lucid visions of her past. She saw her 5-year-old self slaying her own identical twin, wandering snowdrifts in stamina-building exercises. And finally, she relived a medical procedure received on her 14th birthday as a frightened girl in a Red Army hospital where a surgeon drew his scalpel beneath her belly button. The trauma of this memory sent her vital signs racing, forcing her abductors to end the encounter and return her to Earth. The scene had enraged TNT executives, who were already developing a space franchise with a nephew of Ridley Scott. They gave Silvers a dressing down, saying he'd be making DMV collision reels if any of Stalin's daughters so much as bought a helium balloon. At home that night, Silvers found an even greater superior awaiting him, the intergalactic reality producer Tan Calvin. Calvin's people, Silvers had learned, were plagued by horrible body shame. The cosmos had given them so much, a cushy perch in a quiet stretch of galaxy, minds so powerful they'd moved from the wheel to quantum physics in a single century. But physical beauty had been denied them. They had, in response, mastered shape-shifting, donning appropriated forms to indulge escapist fantasies and to avoid traumatizing their colonized peoples. For Silver's benefit, Calvin had chosen the form of a champion rower from Oxford's class of 1913, a man whose thick, wavy hair and alabaster skin had inspired poetry among his peers before a Krupp shell killed him at the Somme. He laid a powerful hand on Silver's shoulder. "You of all people would agree that what's good for the greater program is what matters. We require a new direction." A black Beretta lay on the table. "Just a little more time," Silvers begged. "Give me one more season." Calvin replied with a farting noise. "Please," said Silvers, rushing to his dining table, crafted from a sequoia that was a sapling when Calvin wrote the Christ myth from scraps of pagan lore. "I have ideas," he explained. "So many ideas." He rolled out his final opus across the table. Plot tree forest filling 6 feet of butcher paper, 1,000 storylines that would send Joseph Stalin's daughters to distant galaxies, escaping all detection until massive Nielsen ratings had made Mitch mighty. "It's not just you, Mitch. We're winding down the whole earthly production. We're moving on to the inner triangulans." "Who?" "It doesn't matter. Human things have long since jumped the shark. Extinction is destiny. That's never been a secret. I'm doing you a kindness, Mitch. Dark days ahead. Systemic collapse, fiery wrath, toddler cannibalism." "Toddlers?" "As soon as their teeth come in. It's a crowded interstellar entertainment marketplace. Takes ever more to break through the clutter." "Calvin, what? Let me see your real face." "I'd rather not. Please. I revealed myself once to a girl here a long time ago. I still regret it. I'm cruelly maligned for it. You people have such a narrow view of beauty. Please, I want to see." But both Silver's curiosity and his will to resist were dissolved by a flash of Calvin's eyes. Then the condo's stereo switched on. Slavic wailing, sadder than piss-stained snow, gaining in volume as Calvin said, "Pick up the fucking gun, Mitchell." Silvers palmed the weapon, face beating sweat. Calvin's tongue licked his perfect teeth just before he coolly instructed, "Slowly, not a trace of fear in your being. You will rise from your chair and move toward the window." Silvers obeyed. Standing, walking into a brilliant light suddenly washing into the room, golden, calming, relieving him of the burden of himself. Whatever happened now was fine, faded. Nothing bad could come from a moment that felt so totally good. "Mitchell Silvers, are you ready for your parting gift?"
"I am," Silvers said, voice breaking.
"Yes, Calvin.
I am."
And so he received his final frames of consciousness. False memory streamed into his mind so that he experienced them as his own personal history while describing them aloud. "I see Georgie," whispered Silvers. I see Georgie. She's so beautiful. Yes, she is. Her face close to mine. I feel her breath on my skin, her lips so soft against my ear. She whispers. She tells me she loves me. Let it take you. She loves me, said Silvers. Calvin, I was loved.
Yes, and now you lift up the gun.
Silvers obeyed, shedding tears of joy, raising the pistol to his head. She loved me.
Bravo!
I was loved.
Bravissimo!
Then Mitchell Silver's brain splattered across the windows where they'd cook for 3 days in the sun, generally admired by neighbors who mistook them for art. Chapter 5. Georgie discovered the body. It was a Wednesday afternoon. She and Silvers had scheduled a meeting to discuss a spin-off series. She left Brentwood in the silver Porsche at 2:07 p.m., taking Santa Monica Boulevard to Lincoln, then Lincoln into Venice Beach. At 2:24, she passed the condo's front desk, and at 2:28, she exited the elevator into Silver's penthouse, where nature, ever thrifty, was hatching blowflies from his corpse. She gagged against the stench, then turned from Mitchell's body to the final product of his tortured mind, his unfinished symphony, the disjointed storylines for Oksana's Adventures in Space. In suicide, Silvers had derailed Georgie's hopes to finally be first on the call sheet, killing any chance for her spinoff. TNT quickly canceled Oksana. Stalin's daughters were left frozen at the end of season 4, discovering their father's corpse in the Moscow sewers, learning he'd ordered them all sterilized to keep his genes under strict control. With her 40th birthday approaching, watching this very fertility-focused last episode, Georgie felt a driving maternal urge, a desire, quite natural, to reclaim the right of motherhood she'd signed away in her domestic partnership agreement with Jim. She broached the matter one night as they ate ceviche on the back patio of the Hummingbird Estate, the artificial waterfall running against jackhammerings of neighboring mansions metastasizing from great to gargantuan. Do you ever get lonely? Just us? Jim pretended not to hear her against the hammers and the water. What? Wouldn't you like a little girl, a little boy? I thought we discussed this. I thought we were clear. People change. I've changed. You can change all you want, but you can't make me a father again. What gives you the right to deny me motherhood? You did. When? From the beginning. We had an agreement. As he stared coolly through her, she thought of the Blueberry 9000, a Japanese sex robot she'd seen while Googling, a steel and plastic woman complete with mouth, anus, and vagina, all imbued with advanced robotic clenching powers. It could sigh, moan, scream. And it was only a matter of time, said one Tokyo technology reporter, before cyborgs and humans dance in the fat and honeyed lands beyond the uncanny valley, sharing love as a feedback loop between all that was ever wished and all that has ever been. Words that had stuck with her. What am I to you? Her hands were burning. Right now? Right now, you're someone who's going back on a contract, is what you are right now. Lots of women don't want children. You said you were one of them. His voice turned to pleading. What are you doing? Callous, yes, but honest. This relationship was fueled by Carrie's deep need of maternal love, something Georgie was hard-pressed to deliver in the first place. How could she sustain the dynamic while nurturing a child of her own? And yet how could she endure it without one? She left the house, drove to stay with Lenestra Del Monte in Pasadena. For Carrie, it was the opposite of endless motherly acceptance. It was indifferent abandonment. He begged for her return, by turns plaintive and enraged. 2 weeks later, low on cash, she came back. But distrust had infected intimacy. He began counting her birth control pills and found sex so infected by anxiety that he couldn't maintain an erection. He turned to Viagra, and Georgie would lie beneath him, wondering, as Carrie struggled toward climax, if it might be nice to have a Japanese sex robot on hand to relieve her of the conjugal burdens that now seemed obligatory, mechanical, and even, she resisted the word, servile. One day she dug up their cohabitation agreement from his office drawer and felt a sudden nausea to read that there were 3 more years before a breakup scenario would yield her a dime. And she felt no guilt at all, savoring sweet schadenfreude when the fates delivered Carrie just a bit of the torment they'd long visited on her. His 2 finest performances in The Truman Show and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind had been ignored by the Academy. Making I Love You, Philip Morris was supposed to change that. It told the true story of a devoted husband, Stephen Russell, who discovers his homosexuality following a violent car crash, then abandons his family to pursue a life of fraud, cons, and hedonism. Sent to prison, he finds love with a fellow inmate, ultimately faking advanced AIDS so they can live together in Key West. Carrie had expended huge professional capital on its production, fighting to keep a scene of his character in the act of anal penetration, even defying CAA's mass psychologist, whose warning, America has issues with sodomy, had all but predicted the New York Times review. A star vehicle whose first gay erotic moment shows Mr. Carey engaged in loud anal sex is asking for trouble, which it found. The Bible Belt was written off from the start, but his capacity for vengeance was sorely underestimated. Carey became the target of jeremiads from the pulpit of the Reverend Reggie Lyles Jr., a 29-year-old new revivalist standing 5'7" in 3-inch heels. His 5-hour radio show reached 3 million people in America, and each week he raged against Jim Carrey's degradation of the American family, his promotion of adultery and divorce, his complicity in a gay cabal. Even after distributors abandoned the film, Reggie's acolytes, whipped into a fervor, pressed on with the crusade. Security feeds showed 3 figures arriving at the Hummingbird Estate in a pickup truck one night at 4:13 a.m., wearing ski masks. They spray-painted "God Hates Fags" on his gate, then turned to his security cameras, quoting lines from Revelation. "And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy." They'd emptied barrels of bloody guts down his driveway, then, in a mad dash, befouled his swimming pool with the heads of the 3 pigs who'd provided the guts. "Always pigs," Carrie's security chief, the former Israeli army commando Avi Ayalon, said, watching the bloated heads bob in the water. "Someone wants to send a message? They always go with swine. Filthy animals, very intelligent. Did you know they eat their own?" Security was enhanced across the estate. Avi moved temporarily into the pool house and, through Mossad connections, procured Jophiel, the steel-fanged Rottweilers that would in time be Carrie's only friends. The creatures came pre-trained. "Kowtow," said Carrie, reading from the command list. "Kowtow." And as the Rottweilers whimpered at his feet, he smiled his humongous billboard smile He felt the dogs were fully worth their $100,000 price tags, the warmth of the wish that money could bring death to heal. He and Georgie began savoring the nightly ritual where, per the training regimen, they'd hurl a lamb shank out into the yard, crying, "Intruder!" and watch the beasts tear toward it, rip it apart, clocking the response times. While these dogs brought protection from marauding born-agains, they offered none from the greater film industry. I Love You, Philip Morris ended its run losing millions. Now it was Carrie's turn for a lesson in powerlessness. He was nearing 50, his fans aging too. His talent was such that Hollywood could not replace him in its usual way, the kind of body snatching that saw Emma Stone swapped in for Lindsay Lohan, Leonardo DiCaprio taking over for River Phoenix. But still, they could tame, control, punish. Disney and Paramount froze slated projects. A third, at Sony, was quietly killed. It hardly mattered that Carrie was still beloved, as his agents said, from the Ganges to the Andes, a reliable global draw. All across Los Angeles, estimations of his industrial worth declined so steeply that his managers, Wink Mingus and Al Spielman II, arranged an emergency phone call to discuss what was then being called the situation. "We need to reaffirm the Carrie brand," preached Al Spielman II. "We need something with penguins or polar bears," said Wink. "People love animals. People miss the days when they lived in jungles among animals and heard their own souls and the sounds of those animals. That's why Ace Ventura worked." "I think it was the character they liked," said Carrie. Wink Mingus said under his breath, "Ace Ventura worked because Ace Ventura loved animals just like people do. They saw their animal love in his." "We need something four quadrant," said Al, "and fast." Then he sighed the sigh of his heart surgeon father, Al Spielman Sr., a sigh to suggest that while the situation was dire, heroic procedures might, just might, deliver a miracle. It usually bent Carrie to his will, but here, to Al's dismay, it had no effect. "I've done nothing wrong," said the star on his patio, Jophiel, gnawing lamb bones at his feet. "Why should I make some stupid family film?" "You want to tell him, Deuce?" asked Wink. "I do," said Al. "Then do." "You apologize so you don't end up playing lounges in Vegas," blurted Al. Early gigs in Vegas had always sapped Carrie's soul. He'd feared growing old there, dying there. In nightmares, he'd seen his own desert-aged face, an image that now returned, jowly with bleached teeth and hair plugs, whoring for the bingo crowds. He froze, dread-struck. "I'd listen to him, Jimbo. Don't want to end up back in Vegas, playing for the bustin' package tours, old ladies clutching change purses." The haunting deepened. A close-up on his orange spray-tanned face, a weary persona, playing greatest hits on eternal loop for casino crowds. Why was this vision so clear? Was this end somehow fated? He wondered all this just beneath his breath. "What you mumbling?" asked Wink Mingus. "Huh? You think you're hireable right now, Jim?" "If Robert Downey Jr. is hireable, I'm hireable." "Downey never fucked a guy in the ass on film." "What's wrong with playing gay?" "It's not commercial. Leads to confusion. A couple of my golfing buddies started asking about you." "Oh, yeah? Are they cute?" A click on the line. "Deuce," said Wink. Silence. "Nice going, Jimbo." "I don't want to do some middle-of-the-road family movie, Wink. It amounts to propaganda for the wars. We're just distracting. Well, going into the underground parking. Gonna lose you." Then Wink Mingus was gone too, and Carrie all alone with his fears. He walked off the patio, across his lawn, up through the ravine to his cypress wood prayer platform. There, sitting half lotus, Jophiel tight by his sides, He closed his eyes and beseeched the cosmos. Guide me. Show me. Use me. And, like so many of his prayers, this one was answered. 2 weeks later, on a clear night after days of rain, a 1988 Volvo 240 station wagon approached the Hummingbird gates. Pale blue body, rotted and rusty, riding low on his chassis. Georgie was asleep, Carrie alone in the living room, watching a YouTube video on the role of cheesemaking in the rise of Genghis Khan. Avi Ayalon heard the Rottweilers howling and checked the security monitors to see a man who hissed, "It's not safe," over and over, demanding, "Open the gates!" Carrie rose to study the night vision figure, hair oily and unkempt, cheeks gaunt, the eyes of a biting creature. Only his voice defined him as more than a straggling junkie, as Charlie Kaufman, the shape-shifting auteur who had written Carrie the finest role of his career with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. "Kaufman?" Carrie gasped. "Let him in." Jophiel growled as he entered. Kaufman was tunnel-eyed and jittery, hoodie pulled tight as he shielded his face from the foyer's security cameras, insisting they speak outside. The dogs followed them to the back patio, where Carrie and Kaufman sat on a teakwood bench beneath a sky of depthless blues, the night air sweet with mangoes rotting in the trees above. "You got a cell phone on you?" asked Kaufman. Carrie produced the gadget from his pocket. Kaufman snatched it from his hand, throwing it hard into the pool, hushing Carrie until it had sunk to the bottom. "Christ, Charlie!" "Oh, yes. Be scared. These are vicious people." "Who?" "They got to my maid, Magda. She did some public pissing films back in Berlin right after the wall fell. You know the drill. Squatting by the Reichstag, hiking up her skirts, a healthy flowing golden shower. Artful stuff, even if it wasn't. Christ, Jimmy, she was just a kid trying to get by, taking a pee, reclaiming the odd square foot of history. And they used this past against her, blackmailed her into poisoning my pet butterflies, Jan and Dean. I found them bobbing, lifeless, in their sugar water. I lifted them out with my fingers. So delicate. I kept blowing on them, Jimmy. I kept wishing my breaths could bring them back to life." Kaufman paused, wiping tears from his eyes. "Charlie, what's..." "They fried my hard drives. Hacked my house so all the lights flicker and strobe, and my stereo plays secret recordings of Richard Nixon confessing dreams to a shrink. You know what Dick Nixon dreamed? He dreamed of himself as a young boy leaping from a rusty swing set toward a distant Wabash freight train, whistling songs of escape velocity, offering the promise of being anywhere but where he was. He leaps from the swing. He soars so high, little Dickie, seeming to fly toward that train, then falling toward the place where his shadow should be, but isn't. The void. They're sending me a message, making it very clear. These people, they'll disappear you. Make it look like a heart attack, a suicide. Hang you from a ceiling fan, pants around your ankles, your cock in hand, big kitchen spoon up your... This is crazy talk. I got people coming for me. I'm haunted by a monster. Charlie, what kind of monster? Krugeresque. But no more hiding. I got to tear him out from my nightmares, into the light of day, which is art. And you're the only guy who can help me." "Help you what?" "Strike him before he kills me." "Who?" Shivering with the twin chills of fear and desert night, Kaufman dared to whisper his tormentor's name. "Mao Zedong." "Mao Zedong? The brutal father of modern China?" "Shh! But he's dead." "Is he?" "Mao, director of the largest, most lethal theatrical production ever conceived. Isn't that what a revolution is, Jimmy? The pageantry. The lights, the music, the costumes. Lavish set design on a massive scale. It's the ultimate mashup of genres. Romance, action-adventure, murder mystery, thriller, coming of age, fantasy. Mao, who promised to end all bourgeois privilege, then married a sexy Shanghai actress. Mao, who starved millions while lazing poolside, getting fat and writing bad poetry. And what's that telling us about hidden circularities? Why do these monsters yearn toward beauty? You ever go wandering alone at dinner parties? Say you've got to pee, then explore all the rooms of the house. I do that all the time. You know how many Hitler landscapes hang in Hollywood's private collections, behind false panels? I count 17. Ever shave off a full beard? You just got to try that little mustache before you're done. Next thing, you're spouting fake German goose-stepping around the bathroom. We've all got it in us, man. Charlie, what's happened to you? Kaufman dropped his hood, then recounted his season in hell. That autumn, acting on a therapist's advice that travel might free him from troubling dreams of his boyhood self in a cowboy outfit on a Coney Island carousel, he'd agreed to judge the Shanghai Biennale with Taylor Swift and Jeff Koons. Afterward, they'd been taken on a tour of luxury condominiums across China's northern provinces with representatives of the Biennale's major sponsors, Louis Vuitton, Morgan Stanley, and the People's Liberation Army. In rural Hainan, hiking on a sloped hillside, they were caught in the first spring rains. Mudslides came roaring down all around them. Struggling to save her Pucci scarf with one hand, her iPhone with the other, Taylor Swift felt her big toe catch in the earth. She twisted and wriggled, but couldn't free it from the muddy suction. It was trapped, she saw, looking down, in the eye socket of a human skull. Horrified, she'd gasped a perfect E-flat that hung in the air as more human remains surfaced around her. Rib cages tangled with spines, jutting femurs, grasping hands, all rising up from the liquid hillside. She was far from Nashville now, wandered into a mass grave from China's great famine, the starvation of 40 million caused by Mao's great leap forward. But large numbers of peasant dead were considered off-brand by Morgan Stanley, the Chinese government, and Louis Vuitton alike. A cover-up was concocted. Taylor Swift traded silence for the rights to bring her fashion line to the Chinese market with a runway show on the Great Wall. Koons was allowed to sculpt a gigantic slinky on the steps of Beijing's Forbidden City. Kaufman had been offered generous film financing, but had alone refused cooperation. Cinema, he'd always believed, mimics life as a system of disparate images, affecting unified experience through the magic of sequence and speed. For him, the mass grave's surfacing was in all ways a haunting, a frame from the past usurping the present. And as the storm's wind wheezed through skeletal cavities, he'd heard an anguished voice speaking from beyond time, imploring him, "Remember us, Charlie. Tell the world of the monster who put us here. Don't let us be forgotten once the army bulldozers have plowed us back under." Back in Shanghai, he stayed at the Peace Hotel, wondering how Mao's crimes would best be treated in cinema, jotting ideas down as they came. Horror seemed the right genre. Something like The Omen, The Exorcist. What if Mao's spirit was hatched? No, reborn. Yes, like a hungry ghost, refusing death, latching on to some equally gruesome modern entity. That was it. He'd popped his Xanax and gone for a walk along the Huangpu River, returning hours later to find his room ransacked, his laptop stolen, a new note scrawled on his pad, seemingly written in his penmanship by the Chinese Ministry of State Security agent, already assigned to his containment. Silence is golden. He'd fled with just his passport, and a hit of inspiration making clear the scope of his project and its required star. "I need you, Jimmy," he said now. "You gotta be my Mao." "Madness," Carrie hissed. "They'll hang me for playing Asian." Kaufman had already addressed this. To take Mao head-on, as Daniel Day-Lewis might, would only arrive at the comic grotesque. But to channel him through the comic grotesque, well, that might deliver the fullness of his horror. Kaufman's Mao would be respawned inside the mind of a tormented actor. Jim Carrey, a star who, fearing his own collapse, explores the same dark appetites that guided Mao. The wish to be worshipped forever, to escape mortality by commanding history. A man who, convinced the character of Mao Zedong will be his raging bull, opens himself evermore to the tyrant's spirit, his lusts, his vanities, until he is devoured completely. Carrie was appalled, and yet, in Charlie's hands? Who knew? It could be a masterpiece, his Oscar vehicle, something to make Tommy Lee Jones, who'd never given him his due and always called him a buffoon on the set of Batman Forever, croak of jealousy, that whiskey-soaked Harvard shit, God bless him. Kaufman unfolded a worn treatment. Scratching out the opening sentence, he scribbled a new one in its place and read it aloud. "Jim Carrey and Charlie Kaufman sit beneath a sky of depthless blues, the night air sweet with mangoes rotting in the trees above." The camera goes close on Carrey. "How does it begin?" he asks, voice tinged with a tragic naivete. Carrey closed his eyes, head spinning, imagining himself, playing Mao. He asked, "How does the movie begin?" "With the hunger." A long crane shot, digital, rising over a soaring pile of starving peasants. Thousands, millions, tens of millions. Infants, children, mothers, fathers, the elderly. Their final breaths, gasps, rattles, joined in singing an ancient harvest song. These are the innocents whose lives Mao devoured, feed for his demon dreams. Slowly, the camera cranes up the piled bodies, pulling back as it ascends, ever further, until the moment of maximum removal when we see this is all an inverted image set in Mao Zedong's milky, dying eyeball. He's on a steel surgical bed, hooked up to respirators, an affront to the word alive. Kaufman lowered the script. "You're perfect for this. Who else could do it?" Clearing his throat, he returned to the page. "Time misbehaves in death. Minutes cough up centuries. Seconds excrete millennia. So it is here. We go from Mao's POV as the embalming team plug rubber tubes into his arteries, pump him full of formaldehyde. He's trapped in his own body, not alive and yet undead. Tormented by something just beyond the flesh, something that here, finally, holds him in its clutches. Reckoning, he can't escape it. And as he shrieks inside himself like a man buried alive, the camera dissolves from Mao's bloated, gruesome, famous face to..." "To what?" whispered Carrie. "To yours." Chapter 6. Charlie Kaufman was living on the run. He'd fled his bungalow for the Saharan Motor Hotel, an old Sunset Boulevard flea bag, where he'd guide Jim Carrey's spirit toward Mao's. Carrey had stayed at the motel when he came to Hollywood in 1982. Arriving with just $600, a suitcase of clothes, and a second-hand copy of an apocalyptic bestseller, Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth. The author claimed to have cracked secret codes in the Bible, and through them to have learned that nuclear annihilation was only months away, the end of everything at hand. Carrie had read it in a sun-warped plastic chair overlooking the Saharan swimming pool, fetid water bobbing with cigarette butts and candy bar wrappers, the haggled ecstasies of hookers and Johns sounding from nearby rooms. Sometimes, lonely, he joined them. Sometimes he made his cruddy mattress wince with Tammy the peroxide blonde in the white leather miniskirt who worked outside the comedy store. Sometimes with freckled Vicky from Montana, who wished for soap opera stardom while hustling the rush hour traffic. Sometimes Vicky's fake Chanel perfume lingered on his skin as he read the late great planet Earth above the motel pool. And sometimes, looking up, he'd daydream 1,000 ICBMs streaking silver across the sky, could hear them all whistling down toward impact, and braced, awaiting the moment when the motel's bricks and the book's pages and his own flesh would be vaporized, then blown out to sea by cleansing desert winds. Vanishment, obliteration, strange imaginings for an aspiring star. But in his most desolate moments, when his jokes didn't land, when he feared returning home to Canada a failure, he'd wanted it so badly, anything to spring him from the stretching rack of dreaming. But the missiles never flew, and the person of Jim Carrey only grew across the decades, soaring from blockbuster to blockbuster. Those early days were far from his mind as he entered the Saharan that week. Kaufman greeted him in footed pajamas, printed with 50s images of Tonto and the Lone Ranger. He gave Jim a squirrely nod, turned to a figure splayed out on the bed, a paunchy man in a once ivory linen suit, now splotched with sweat stains. The man drew 3 dramatizing breaths, then flicked up the brim of his battered Panama hat to reveal a famous face in the morning sun. Carrie gasped. Hopkins. It is impossible to overstate the importance of Anthony Hopkins's participation in the entire Mao affair. He was the first of Hollywood's masters to endorse Carrie's dramatic talents, writing the star to hail Dumb and Dumber as a fearless exploration of the savageries of class and the miracle of friendship. They had bonded at the 1998 Golden Globes, after realizing they both inhabited characters through the spirits of animals. Carrie had based his Ace Ventura on an intelligent bird. Hopkins's Hannibal Lecter was a hybrid crocodile tarantula with infinite patience. The Menagerists, they dubbed themselves, and remained close. Kaufman had asked Hopkins to play the memory of Richard Nixon in the mind of Jim Carrey, playing himself, preparing to play Mao, a ghost inside a ghost. He'd accepted, offering to join in preparations. For Carrie, his presence transformed the sordid motel room into a place of destiny. You once called me the Lewis and Clark of the dramatic wilds, said Hopkins. But as old age brings sexlessness, am I not just as much your Sacagawea? I think so. The child I hold to my bosom is art. My teat's milk is craft. Let us, then, cross these frontier wilds. Let us find our fair Pacific, our... He yawned, then seemed to forget he'd been speaking at all. He held a glass of burgundy, the crystal clouded with lip prints. Jim wondered what had brought Hopkins back to the bottle. It was a woman. Hopkins had spent that winter directing Titus Andronicus at Yale's drama school, and there had fallen in love with a poet, Elise Evans, author of a Pulitzer Prize shortlisted collection, The Scarified Heart. She'd lost her first husband, the mountain climber Chug Stanton, to a Himalayan avalanche. Her second, an archaeologist, had left her for an older woman. She'd forsaken love as a biological ploy until Hopkins arrived. They'd spent that winter in her faculty suite, sharing warm baths as blizzards howled beyond the leaded windows. Hopkins felt his whole life had been a prelude to her touch, and with April's early blossoms, decided the rest of his days should be just like these. He'd bought a sapphire engagement ring and booked flights to Mystique. At the York Street J Press, he was fitted for the ivory linen suit in which he'd hoped to marry her, sucking in his gut before a three-way mirror that refracted him into an infinity of bliss. Just a few more seasons together was all he'd wanted. In a flash of sunshine, it had seemed so tauntingly possible. But his bones had betrayed him, femur and tibia grinding arthritically as he kneeled to propose, pain searing the joint, leg buckling beneath him. Crumpled before her, he'd begged the universe to go back just 5 seconds. His heart wilted as her lips touched his forehead, the kiss of a mourner, not a lover. Looking up, he saw her eyes flooded with feared loss, tears trickling off her lips as she said, "Oh, Tony, I can't. I'm so sorry." Damned fool, he'd cursed himself, riding Amtrak down from New Haven. Goddamned fool, done in by your own creaky skeleton. How many loves does life owe anyone? None. So what were you thinking? That she'd nurse you into senility? Change your diapers? Goddamned fool. He'd ranted aloud, causing at least one other passenger to believe Hopkins was berating him as they stood in the cafe car. "There's much to accomplish," he said to Carrie now, half of him still lost in the pain of love's memory. "Let us begin." So Carrie settled beside Hopkins as Kaufman flicked on the flat screen to play the first scenes of a carefully planned character indoctrination. Footage from Mao's famine recently sent to him with a note that read, "You have friends in Taipei." Charlie had set the reels to slow motion, 1/64th real time, wanting Carrie to fully absorb every frame of Mao's murders. That day they lay on the king-size bed for 6 hours, watching hell on earth. Panning shots of starving people tending to crude blast furnaces, lining up for meager rice rations, patrolled by men with guns. Interiors of huts packed with children, too near death to even eye the camera. On and on, a man-made hellscape. Carrie, who knew nothing of Chinese history, soon wondered why all these people were suffering. An earthquake? Flood? War? Worse. Hopkins sipped his wine. A dream. A grand design. Mao traded all the grain to Russia for capital goods, guns, the dangled hope of atomic power. He collectivized the land, made the peasants melt down their plows for steel. He wanted China to surpass Russia in wealth and stature. He wanted radios and kitchens and cars and driveways. Stalin engineered a famine to industrialize, so Mao did the same. He thought it a path to paradise. "Utopia," said Kaufman, "more gruesome than Gomorrah." "Yes," said Hopkins. "Mao promised a great leap forward. Deliverance from feudalism. He never said how he'd get it done." "What did he do?" Carrie asked. "China was poor in everything except people," said Hopkins. "So he devoured them, taking lives as raw fuel. Guru Viswanathan, we will remember, had once taught Carrie to visualize the coloration of his aura. As Kaufman showed him what Mao had done while the millions died. Reels of the despot dancing with silk-clad starlets at Shanghai garden parties, gorging on pork and whiskey, smoking his beloved cigarettes. He felt a spiritual pollution, a dimming of his rose-gold glow." "He doesn't even care," Carrie gasped. Power never cares, said Hopkins. Watch how Mao lived while they died. Decadent parties, wild orgies, all raged in his villa while the masses starved. And as Mao danced his lovers across the screen, fear roiled in Carrie's mind. Heath Ledger had lost himself to the Joker. Willie Loman had dragged Philip Seymour Hoffman into the void. Carrie regarded Ledger as an exceptional talent struck down too young. But Hoffman? Philip Seymour Hoffman? He could do certain things that Hoffman couldn't. But Hoffman? Just the name. His toes clenched. There was an artist. The unassuming excellence. Magical. The depth of transformation. Hoffman was great, maybe in the line of Brando and De Niro. Hoffman, dead on the floor of a West Village apartment. The man had everything and still found this life so unbearable he numbed himself into oblivion. Carrie thought now of those early maps of a flat earth, water and ill-fated ships cascading off the edges, monsters playing in the margins. And he wondered if they were not geography at all, but renderings of the inner self. Keep to the warm seas, stray not from trade routes. It was madness to conjure Mao's demons, and yet, the rewards. Hoffman as Truman Capote, Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. The acclaim, sweet fame, mother's touch, fellating validation. Now want of greatness overrode fear, blinding him to the misery on the flat screen. He saw himself at some future Oscar ceremony, wearing a sleek Armani tux, thin lapels. He'd have lost 20 pounds by then. The whole world marveling at his fitness while scenes of his Mao played on giant screens before a fawning academy. He saw Tommy Lee Jones there in the audience, gaunt and gizzard-necked, slumped in his seat, reduced to